Welcome, Time Ladies and Time Lords, to a Worst Foot Forward, Third Foot bonus episode celebrating all things Doctors and indeed Who's. It's the 60th anniversary of the long-running sci-fi program Doctor Who, now owned, like all of us, by Disney. and with Gallifrey now under the auspices of the House of Mouse, we'll have to be extra careful what we say, not to be sued. But nevertheless, to celebrate the 60 years of Doctor Who, Ben, I'm going to take you on a journey through space and time.
And I'm going to take you on a journey through length and width. And we will manage all of the dimensions.
One of us is bigger on the inside than on the outside. And maybe by the end of this, we'll discover who.
It's clearly my capacious brain, but... Yeah. But bigger on the inside. There's no way of saying that without sounding a little bit bawdy.
Yes, yeah.
I would like a Disney crossover where all of the regenerations are just how the Disney characters came along. So Mickey Mouse regenerates into Donald Duck, who regenerates into Goofy, who regenerates into Pinocchio.
Oh, no. I'm a real doctor.
Yeah. Oh, God, he would be the worst Disney character to be a Doctor Who character.
Oh, I can see Donald being a really annoying companion.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I mean, listen, it is absolutely the wrong animation house, but for the past 90 seconds, my brain has been repeating the same phrase over and over, and that phrase is Foghorn Leghorn as Doctor Who. You know you want to see it.
Well, before we go down the fan fiction route too deeply, we'll be safe in the knowledge that many more have been there before us anyway. Ben and I are recording this just shortly after Doctor Who's 60th anniversary. And if you are someone who does not know what Doctor Who is, oh, how to even try and recite 60 years of history to you. But in brief, we're on the 14th Doctor now.
Who's the same as the 10th Doctor?
Who's the same as the 10th Doctor? Already it's tarty complicated for new entrants. Essentially, the Doctor, as they are known, and not Doctor Who, unless you're in a couple of the Peter Cushing films, the Doctor is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey who goes on adventures in space and time, often accompanied by human companions. And one of the great features of the Time Lords in the mythos of the show is that they can regenerate, giving the show an extra special longevity.
Also, that is now one of the fundamental underwriting parts of the NHS philosophy, that you just have to hope that your doctor can regenerate, and then that's how you will get an appointment within 3 weeks.
Oh, I thought you meant they'd insist that all patients should have two hearts and the capacity to regenerate from now on, just to try and ease pressures on waiting lists.
Oh, that would help, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'd be gutted if I died and then regenerated. I was like, oh, God, more of this. No, I just want the sweet release of death, not to wander around with Matthew McConaughey's face.
No, did you watch Doctor Who growing up?
Very little of it. So I was right at the. But again, for those who don't know, Doctor Who took a hiatus from I think 1989, 1990, all the way through to the mid noughties. So Sylvester McCoy was my Doctor, and I've got vague memories of my brother having him on in the background. But it sort of, it passed me by. And I got swept along on the Eccleston and Tennant train, enjoyed some of the opening carriages of the Matt Smith train, and then decided to dismount occasionally, hopping on for a station or two of Capaldi and...
Jodie Whittaker.
Thank you, Jodie Whittaker, who I put both Capaldi and Whittaker in the same box as I put Daniel Craig, of like... Good Bond, bad scripts.
Fair enough. Well, are you excited for the new era?
I am. I watched it on Saturday night after my gig and was extremely delighted with an awful lot of it.
Yeah. I grew up in Ireland where Doctor Who was not really a going concern, and indeed I was of age during the hiatus that you mentioned as well.
But I thought you were going to say I grew up in Ireland where Doctor Who was illegal.
It was illegal, yes. It was considered heresy.
Yes.
But I have an inexorable link to it now, having done a little bit of voice work in it. Ascension of the Cybermen, an episode set in Ireland. I say three words. If you listen very carefully, you can hear my voice saying the words "move around now." And also
Ascension
then I was in the...
of the Cybermen. That is the most Catholic name possible.
Yes, it was set in Ireland, that episode as well. And then I was in the immersive Doctor Who show, Doctor Who Time Fracture. I'm actually wearing a bit of costume that I stole. Actually, people will be able to hear on my mic the jingling. I'm wearing the dog tags that my character, who was a unit soldier, wore every night underneath my costume. So the audience didn't know I was wearing them. And given that pretty much all the other bits of set were glued down to stop Intrepid Who fans from stealing them. it was the only thing I could keep. And then if anyone's watching any clips on this that we might be posting online, you might be able to see in the background, I've got a Doctor Who magazine someone gave me as a gift, and I've got a Cyberman Taskmaster trophy. As a cast, we played games of Taskmaster in between two show days, and a lovely friend of mine, Tom Telford, made us all trophies. In fact, one of the winners was a friend of the show, Angus Duncan. Anyway, to business. I read a bit about the origins of Doctor Who, first of all, and who developed it. And the head of drama at the BBC in the 1960s was a chap called Sidney Newman. And apparently he wrote the first format document for the series, along with the head of the script department, Donald Wilson, and a staff writer called C.E. Weber. And they had initially tried to come up with a program that would appeal to a family audience as an educational program. So the time travel element was meant to, you know, teach people about famous moments and explore scientific ideas and so on. And so in July 1963, they commissioned a writer called Terry Nation to write a story under a title, The Mutants. And the plot of this was that two alien races, the Daleks and the Thals, were the victims of an alien neutron bomb attack. And I think then the Doctor was going to come in and try and save the day. But then Nation changed and dropped the aliens and made the Daleks the aggressors. And when he presented the script to Newman and Wilson, they rejected it because Newman was particularly averse to, and I quote, bug-eyed monsters, or BEMs, as he used to refer to them in those, according to a chronicler at the time. We didn't have a lot of choice. We only had the Dalek serial to go. We had a bit of a crisis of confidence because Donald Wilson was so adamant that we shouldn't make it. Had we had anything else ready, we would have made that. So they had to come up with a different script entirely for the first series. But Terry Nation's script later became the second Doctor Who serial. So in the early days, you'd often have like one storyline over four 25, 35 minute episodes. And so the second one of these was the Daleks. Apparently, Sidney Newman was convinced by one of his assistants, who pointed out that the Daleks aren't really bug-eyed monsters, but they're humanoids whose bodies have atrophied so much that they need the casings that they're in to survive.
I love that already we've entered the world of fan pedantry.
Yeah, very much a feature of Doctor Who. I'm already, like, even doing this episode, I can't even tell you the trepidation I felt. Funny enough, Terry Nation wrote quite a bit for Doctor Who, and a lot of his Dalek scripts had a quirk of characters solving problems using whatever material was available. And unsurprisingly, Terry Nation later went on to write for a show called MacGyver.
Oh, I was going to say he later on was a series editor on Art Attack.
Yeah. Terry Nation, his estate owned the Daleks. So he very cleverly, his agent, the great Beryl Virtue, got the contract when after he'd written the Daleks into this series. And she just deleted the clause which said that he wouldn't get any royalties and sort of insisted he'd get half the royalties instead. So he earned millions from the Daleks, even though he sort of wrote something. Basically, the first script describes them as sort of gliding across the floor like Edwardian dancers, I think. So it doesn't describe them in detail, but we'll talk about who actually designed them later on. But yeah, when the series came back, as he said, in the mid-noughties, there was a big question as to whether they'd be allowed to use the Daleks or not. They had to really negotiate with the Nation estate, so to speak.
See, what I love about that, I still can't deal with the fact that when you talk about someone's earnings and wealth, you use the term estate. I always thought that meant an actual estate in the country. So like the George Harrison estate or the Charles Dickens estate was that. Yeah. And I assumed that the Terry Nation estate, instead of like a pair of stone lions outside the front door, it's just a pair of stone Daleks.
Yeah, you'd hope so. sounds like an interesting guy. He'd written scripts for Tony Hancock, and his estate was later managed by Roger Hancock, Tony's younger brother. And because of Roger's intransigence over the rights to the Daleks, they even, Russell T. Davies, who was the showrunner in the first reincarnation of the new series, they proposed an episode title, Absence of the Daleks, just to prepare for the idea they wouldn't have them.
Oh, I thought you were going to go the other way and make it Doctor Who's Half Hour.
Yeah. JFK nearly killed Doctor Who.
Doctor Who was meant to come out on November the 22nd, 1963.
23rd,
Depends what time zone you're in. I'm talking from a Tahitian point of view.
Sure.
Of course, on that day, Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK and then at the same time managed to kill Aldous Huxley and C.S. Lewis in the greatest trick shot of all time. Do you know how difficult it is to get a bullet from Dallas to Oxfordshire?
Yeah, the first episode was delayed 80 seconds. Some people say 5 or 10 minutes. It was about 80 seconds late because they were covering the JFK assassination. And this first episode was called Doctor Who, An Unearthly Child. And the viewing numbers weren't quite what they'd hoped they would be. So they actually repeated the first part of the serial the following week, just before the second episode went out.
Nice. Yeah, that seems quite an unprecedented move.
Yeah, it was interesting because the show that was on before Doctor Who nominally each week was the Telegoons, which is the animated Goon Show series that you might be aware of, Ben.
Of course I'm aware of it.
Of course you are. So they didn't show that week's episode of the Telegoons when the second Doctor Who episode came out. It was replaced by a repeat of the first episode.
I mean, I feel like sometimes some of the Doctor Who plot lines and some of Spike's plot lines are equally wibbly and wobbly. Has Doctor Who ever addressed the JFK assassination in the way that Red Dwarf did?
Well, funny you should mention that, because when the show rebooted in 2005, so I said, I think it was a 16-year hiatus, the very first episode of the modern series, if you like, was called Rose. And Rose Tyler, played by Billie Piper, is shown a photograph as she's learning about who the Doctor is. And they show her a photograph of the Doctor, i.e. Christopher Eccleston, in the background at JFK's assassination as the motorcade is driving past.
Yes, of course, with the guy, it's Mark something or other who's
Mark
the...
Mark Benton, yes, is Mark the Benton is showing it to her, yeah.
Great character actor.
Yeah,
of course. It does have still my favourite line in all of Doctor Who, of when she meets Christopher Eccleston, it's like, you're an alien, yeah, but you've got a northern accent. Every planet's got to have a north.
Yes, such a great line.
So good.
That first episode, they batted around, as I mentioned, a few different plot lines. The Dalek episode I mentioned, another writer, C.E. Weber, suggests a story where the characters were all shrunk down to miniature size. Another idea would have been set at Christmas, with the Doctor being pursued through time by his estranged wife, the Fairy Godmother. But they landed on the episode, An Unearthly Child, which saw them go back in time to settle a dispute between warring cavemen. Ultimately, and it had to be shot twice as well. The very first episode, there were so many sort of camera errors and things went a bit wrong that the pilot was really shonky, so they shot the pilot twice.
Well, it was also very difficult technically because you had to send the crew back in time first to record the TARDIS when it arrived.
Yeah.
And I imagine they sort of send them back to the wrong era, and obviously logistically it's quite hard to get in contact with a crew.
Very hard to do indeed, yeah. It also featured as a producer Verity Lambert, who was the first female producer at the BBC, and Waris Hussein, who was the first Asian BBC drama director.
I love that it's like pushing boundaries, for want of a better phrase, from day one.
Yeah, and then as I said, the second serial was the Daleks episode, which really kicked things off. Like they were immediately popular with the viewers. The first episode, the ratings hadn't been great. The arrival of the Daleks was so massive that it triggered a thing called Dalek Mania. And the very first merchandising boom the BBC ever experienced was the Daleks. There were people sticking Daleks on everything for a period of time in the 60s.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And obviously, Dalek Mania, they had that big hit, I Want to Exterminate Your Hand.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the Beatles. And again, if people are watching any clips, they might see Ben has a Beatles. ITV were struggling for ratings against Doctor Who, so much so that they put like the Beatles on TV against Doctor Who on one occasion just to try and claw back some viewing figures.
I feel like Doctor Who would still have won.
I think it did, yes. I think they did get more viewers. As I said, I mentioned at the top, the Doctor can regenerate. That was very much an afterthought. And some of the world building of Doctor Who came later. You know, the most casual observer of Doctor Who will be able to tell you that they're a Time Lord, they time travel, and they can after they die, they sort of are, if you like, reborn as a different version of themselves, which allows you to recast the actors. And it very much came from that. The original actor who played the Doctor, William Hartnell, he was poorly, declining health, shall we say, towards the end of the series. And they thought, well, rather than recast off-screen, just have a new series start with another actor, in a revolutionary way, in many ways, they had the regeneration happen on screen. They had him, mm-hmm. you know, lying there and bright lights and his face change into the face of his replacement, Patrick Troughton. And they didn't use, they just called that a renewal. It wasn't until the third.
What, like your TV license?
Yes, yeah. They called it a renewal. The second doctor called it a change of appearance. It wasn't until the third time round they went with regeneration as the term. Years after it was written, apparently, there was a BBC memo found which said that regeneration should be like as if he had taken LSD. Instead of experiencing the kicks, he has the hell and the dank horror that can be its effect. So a bad LSD trip.
Oh.
It's the metaphysical change that should happen to the doctor.
Oh, okay. So when the doctor comes out of his regeneration, he'd just be there just going, shh, looking at my hand. Looking at my hand, I can see all of the letters of the Cyrillic alphabet in there.
Also, as mentioned, the term Time Lord, which is the species that the Doctor is. The Doctor isn't a human, even though he looks like one. He's a Time Lord. They didn't use the phrase Time Lord until the sixth series. And his home planet of Gallifrey isn't mentioned until 10 years on, in 1973.
Oh, wow. I mean, listen, how often do you meet someone and go, and what planet are you from, madam?
Yes. So, do you know who the longest serving Doctor is, by the way?
It is, I think, Pitt the Younger, but...
the longest serving Doctor, technically, is Paul McGann.
Oh, I knew it was going to be a wibbly-wobbly question, because that's who McCoy turns into.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the show went into hiatus in 1989, where Sylvester McCoy was the Doctor. And then in 1996, there was a television film starring Paul McGann.
Yes, there was.
And that was the one that, from 1996 until 2005, if you like, Paul McGann was the Doctor, because there was no other Doctor Who being made. And then in 2005, Christopher Eccleston appears. So if you like, Paul McGann was the Doctor for 9 years, which is longer than any other person, without assuming from the point they assumed the mantle until they regenerate.
So two things. One, I do remember watching that and being slightly baffled by it. I don't know if that film has stood the test of time.
I think at the time it was fairly well received. I'd have to defer to some Doctor Who fans for the overall opinion of it. But yeah, pretty well in the UK, but not brilliantly in America.
Yeah, but Doctor Who is not for Americans. Even if it's popular with them now, it's not. They can have football or Doctor Who. They can't have both. But has McGann turned up again in?
Yes, yeah. In fact, he appeared in, I think, the last episode that Jodie Whittaker was the Doctor in. There's sort of she enters a point in her mind where there's various other incarnations of the Doctor appear, and he does a lot of the audio episodes that Big Finish Audio create as well. The great thing with Doctor Who is, being a time traveler, is there's lots of spin-off stuff where they do audio episodes, and because you just go, well, this happened in a different time in that Doctor's life, they were able to jump into this point in time where they had this adventure, and you have crossovers and things.
I'd like to think of the gap in the Doctor Who Chronicles that was during Paul McGann's tenure as a little bit like the gap in the New Testament, where Jesus goes from 12 to 30. Like, shit. Basically, now, here's a pitch for you. We could make the Doctor Who Apocrypha.
There are, well, again, Ben, funny you should mention that. There are some Doctor Who apocrypha, if you like, and I say apocrypha, it might be erotica in some senses, because during that hiatus, there was a lot of, if you like, bootleg Doctor Who films being made for home distribution, a lot of them starring some of the past Doctors, like Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy.
Really?
And so on. Yeah, and they have, you know, the Doctor being a bit saucy and flirty with various companions and so on. But they're, if you like, they're non-canonical. They weren't being made by the BBC or the production company.
Yeah, so it's basically just years of Lazenby.
it's Never Say Never Again, but all the spin-offs from that.
Yeah.
I looked at some of the design on the show. Obviously, the show was renowned, particularly in its earlier days, for some pretty questionable props and aliens and shaky walls and things. The TARDIS, which is the time-travelling device the Doctor travels in, has always looked
like... Time and relative dimension in space.
Indeed, for acronym fans out there. It's always looked like a police box since the very first time it appeared on screen. But you know why it looks like that?
Because if you're part of the fuzz, you can blend into anywhere at any time.
Well, it is about blending in. It's the first episode, the Doctor and his TARDIS is found in a junkyard in London. Mm-hmm. And the TARDIS has a a cloaking device called a chameleon circuit, which is meant to blend it into whatever time and place it is it's travelled to, but has been broken by it sort of crashing into the junkyard, and it just has remained looking like that ever since. I also like, and I have to thank several of these facts, and I will try and credit them as I go, come from Angus Duncan, past guest of the show, and Sam Hunt, who was in the Time Fracture with me, who's a fount of Doctor Who knowledge, as well as our very own social media manager, Nell. Angus tells me Tom Baker's original scarf was knitted by a fantastically named woman called Begonia Pope. She was basically given a car full of wool and just told to start knitting and not told exactly when to stop. So the final 12-foot scarf that Tom Baker's doctor sports was actually something so big that, and I quote, you couldn't get it in the flat.
So, sorry, so they turned Begonia Pope into a knitting golem.
Yes. Just said, here you go, woman, knit like your life depends upon it.
Knit like your life depends on it. I tell you what, the Knitting Golem is a lost goon show. That's what that's what got bumped when they repeated the first episode.
Yeah, 100%. There's an asteroid named after the TARDIS. 3325 TARDIS was discovered in March 1990. And do you know who was meant to design the Daleks?
Oh, David Hockney.
Not far off a grand old man of an art form. It was Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott really? Worked in scenic design at the BBC, but left just before, like as the Daleks were sort of being envisaged. He just left at that point. Yeah.
They based the Daleks' personality on his. He's renowned on being quite a cantankerous old shithead.
Indeed, yeah. So instead, the Daleks were designed by Raymond Cusick. And he said at one point, people do say I was inspired by a pepper pot, but I always think if that's all it takes to become a designer, then it's a doddle.
I remember watching a brilliant thing about design. I can't remember what it is, but for like objects around the house, some of them very high end, but some of them it was all about the ergonomics of it. And at its heart, it's simple stuff. I mean, it's like writing a good sentence, isn't it? You pare it down until you've got the least words providing the most meaning.
Yes, less is more. Or, you know, occasionally something needs a plunger stuck in the front of it. But
if in doubt, stick a plunger on it.
Yeah, I have to thank Sam for these ones. He provided me with some of the accidents that were suffered on set at Doctor Who. In the episode Greatest Show in the Galaxy, a gate falls too early onto the character the Chief Clown and actually broke his molars.
Ooh,
that takes some doing. Breaking front teeth, tricky enough, but the molars, it's a real good effort. In Battlefield, there was a water tank scene where a glass front smashed and flooded the studio floor. And obviously, there were people terrified of electrocution. The actress who was inside the tank was pulled to safety just before the glass broke because apparently Sylvester McCoy saw that she was in distress because she was aware of the glass beginning to crack. And so the scenic design people above her lifted her up just before the water spread. And apparently, there was a guy on a boom dolly with rubber wheels. And lots of the other crew hopped onto the dolly alongside him to get off the floor, and yelled out, turn the power off. Somebody up in the gantries turned the power off and saved them. Yeah, Sylvester McCoy actually saving some lives as the Doctor. And in the 80s, the Cyberman, I played a Cyberman in Time Fracture.
Yes, I saw, because the amazing thing with Time Fracture was the production values were off the scale.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff we had were genuine props and costumes from the TV show. The Cyberman costume, I don't think it's any spoiler to say, because this is true of most TV props and costumes, they weren't made to be worn for theatrical production, so they were constantly getting lots of TLC. Basically, part of my casting was to see could my head fit in the helmet, because they are a tight fit, yes. Let me tell you.
Could your big Irish head fit inside an alien robot?
Genuinely, there are some people who could not get them on there, yeah. But in the 80s, I mean, we had it easy compared to the 80s. The Cybermen in the 80s, they were literally screwed into their helmets, and at one point, according to Sam, a screw went through someone's ear.
No. Not
and
for me.
That's making Ben cover his eyes. Now, Ben is recording this sat on his sofa. The phrase watching from behind the sofa originates with Doctor Who. Very British phrase. Don't think it travels quite so much, but
no,
in terms of watching something terrified or something too horrible to watch, you sort of climb behind the sofa and peek your head out and watch it.
it began with Doctor Who and then continued in our generation with the England football team at international football tournaments.
Yes. In a Times article from 1973, there's the line, "Still, the Daleks are the boss space horrors, something to get the children hiding behind the sofa." And there was a Museum of the Moving Image exhibition in 1991, which named its Doctor Who exhibition Behind the Sofa. They also used the title for the feature in the Doctor Who collection Blu-rays, where the actors and other people would talk about classic episodes. And in a 2006 interview with Sky News, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, said that he hid from Daleks behind a Windsor Castle settee.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, he didn't sweat while they were on there.
Yeah, no, obviously not. Mary Whitehouse, the morality campaigner in the UK, very famous, she was always complaining about the violence on Doctor Who. And to be fair, she might have had a point at some periods. There was one episode where the Doctor is drowned face down into some water, when they show quite a lot of the drowning bit. And they left it on a cliffhanger. So they left it with the image of the Doctor seemingly dead in the water. And then you had to wait a week to see what happened. And in 1984, the Resurrection of the Daleks episode has a higher body count than the Terminator.
That's a great fact.
Yeah.
Hang on, does that include... I can't include all of the mountains of skulls in the opening scenes of Terminator.
I don't... Yes, I imagine it must be on-screen deaths as opposed to... I mean, to be fair, which of them happens further along in the chronology of history?
It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just getting to the stage. Obviously, my 5.5-year-old, I'm like, oh, you'd like some of this stuff, but some of it will either bore you or it'll freak you out.
You need the A-team approach, where lasers are always hitting the barrels beside the people, who then get thrown sideways in an explosion. That's the sort of violence you need.
I don't think it's the violence that's the problem, because you handled all the violence in Star Wars all right. But then there's movies from 1981, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, obviously one of the greatest movies of all time. But how that ever got a PG is beyond me.
Yeah,
but I was watching the second Eccleston Doctor Who the other night, and I was like, this is teeming with aliens that he will love, but there's still some freaky stuff in it if you're 5.
Yeah, and God knows the Weeping Angels are just the most terrifying thing ever committed to screen.
Yeah.
Also, do you know the Doctor married his daughter?
A Tennant married his daughter from the actual plot of the show.
Yes, David Tennant is married to Georgia Moffat, who plays the Doctor's daughter, Jenny, in an episode called The Doctor's Daughter. David Tennant obviously plays her dad. Georgia Moffat, coincidentally, is the real-life daughter of the fifth Doctor, Peter Davison.
Their marriage cannot fail, or an essential part of the architecture of the universe will come down.
Yeah.
That is my concern. We're so used to performers being problematic that it's hard to look at this nice man and go, this feels problematic, but isn't.
Yes. there was other problematic casting that's happened in the show in the past. Nicola Bryant played the Doctor's companion Perry from 1984 to 86. Mm-hmm. And for her first photo call, the controversial producer at the time, who I will talk about later on, asked her to bring her sexiest, tightest fitting clothes possible for the photo shoot. They basically wanted a really sexy, sexy companion, so much so that they said, you have to be single. So she just hid the fact that she was dating somebody. They also wanted the character to be American, so Nicola Bryant claimed to be American, and even in interviews outside of Doctor Who, did her American accent until after the show had finished.
That's shocking.
I don't think the producers even knew she wasn't American. And they were trying to break the American market, and so she thought, well, if this is going to get me my job, I'll just keep doing my very convincing American accent. And John Pertwee, you sort of think the Doctor needs to be a blank slate for you to create this character. John Pertwee, who played, I think, the third Doctor, had been in the Navy, and his naval tattoo is visible in the 1970 shower scene in the episode Spearhead from Space. Again, thanks to Angus Duncan for this fact. This tattoo has been subsequently retconned by the fan community and explained as a prison brand bestowed upon him by the Time Lords, because at this point in the Doctor's arc, he was in exile from the Time Lords. So, just very dull. Also in that scene, you can just a little bit see the top of John Pertwee's crack in a shower.
I mean... The juxtaposition of Doctor Who and shower scene is very confusing. Like, I'm trying my best to go towards Psycho, but I'm just thinking, well, just listen, the Doctor's got to have some erotic moments, doesn't he?
Yeah. You know, he's lived thousands of years at this point. He must have had some fun. In fact, that was a talking point that you know, the Doctor hadn't been very sexy in the early series with very much platonic friendships, and then you get the Doctors snogging all sorts of people in the recent ones. Well, can't wait to see who Shuti Gatwa snogs. Can't wait.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about another record-breaking aspect of Doctor Who. There's so many records associated with it. It's the record for the most spin-off fiction books inspired by a TV show. There were over 720 spin-offs by 2016. That's obviously increased. It's the most prolific science fiction TV series ever by episode, longest running. The largest collection of Doctor Who memorabilia has over 6,600 items in it. This was in 2016, this fact. There's 872 Doctor Who episodes so far, 301 stories over those 872 episodes. 97 episodes still missing because the BBC thought in their infinite wisdom to delete lots of the footage because they were reusing tape back in those days.
I love stuff like that. It's going, what's this? We've got footage of the moon landings. I know we won't need this in 50 years' time. Let's just record the local Norfolk news on it.
Yeah, it is. Occasionally you get news of, you know, old episodes being rediscovered. Like new fans of the show like Sam and Angus and a friend of the show, Toby Hayduck, and those will talk when one is discovered in, you know, an old news station in a far distant country or in someone's attic. It is huge news. There's lots of sort of important missing episodes that they still want to get hold of, I think, including Hartnell's final episode. I think they have the clip of the regeneration, but maybe not the whole episode.
Oh, wow. It's like, you know, obviously Beatles fans are delighted because the last Beatles song came out at the start of the month from a piece of a cassette that Yoko handed to Paul from John that said "For Paul" on it. And it's taken till now for Peter Jackson to develop the technology to rescue John's voice. And there's got to be a Doctor Who story in there somewhere of Doctor Who meeting up with Lennon and McCartney in the late 70s and helping them make amends.
I wish we had one of the Doctor Who nerds with us. I'd probably be able to say if that has happened yet or not.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Also, I must mention the episode City of Death. It's the first Doctor Who episode shot on location. They shot it in Paris, and it was written by Douglas Adams, who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide. And so it's become, you know, it's an episode that a lot of the modern show runners and writers look at, because obviously Douglas Adams was a genius. And it had record viewing figures, 16 million, the highest ever viewing figures for Doctor Who. That fact is slightly tempered by there was industrial action taking place on ITV at the time, so there was nothing else to watch on television.
when you said it was called City of Death and it was the first Doctor Who to be shot on location, I was like, what, in the underworld?
Yeah, coming live from Hades.
Yes.
And in the case of the most popular Doctor Who episode, The Caves of Androzani from 1984 officially holds the record as the most popular Doctor Who story. It's an average of 9.3 out of 10 on IMDb, and Doctor Who magazine readers have also voted it the best story. But there's a record I was particularly taken by. Mm-hmm. It's a record held by the character Ian Chesterton, as played by William Russell.
Okay.
Ian Chesterton was a science teacher and companion of the first Doctor, played by William Hartnell, and appeared in the very first episode. And he returned to the show 57 years and 120 days after his last appearance.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't it? He left the show, the character left the show in 1965, and he pops up again in Jodie Whittaker's final episode. There's a little sort of support group that meet of past Doctor's companions to talk to one another about their experiences with the Doctor, and John Bishop's character is there, and Ace shows up and a few others. They all sit and have Yaz joins them, and there's an old man in the circle, and that is Ian Chesterton at the time of filming. He was 97 years old, the actor William Russell, and he now holds a Guinness World Record title for the longest gap between TV appearances of a single character.
That's just tremendous.
But let's not get too taken by the good things on the show. Some more Angus Duncan facts. The malfunctioning Roboman, who appears at the beginning of the episode, The Dalek Invasion of Earth. The Robomen are humans converted by Daleks to basically kill themselves, and they walk in. This one in particular is staggering into the River Thames. That particular Roboman later fought Christopher Lambert in a car park in Highlander and choreographed the cool sword fights in The Princess Bride.
the CV we all dream of.
Great CV, yeah. Doctor Who, Highlander, Princess Bride. The last producer of the classic era was a very divisive figure called John Nathan Turner. Very much enjoyed being famous, shall we say, and Doctor Who conventions, he and his boyfriend would sort of pick up devoted fans and take them back to their hotel room and things like that. And so he wasn't the most wonderful human being, but there are interesting facts about him. He, for example, had a dog called Pepsi who he'd take on location, and obviously, you know, time being money, occasionally they would just have to keep shots that had Pepsi fannying around in the background. he also apparently, again, thank you to Angus for this, he apparently cast Colin Baker as the Doctor based almost entirely upon a tour de force best man speech Colin Baker gave at a wedding, which John Nathan Turner was also attending.
Great. Right, just, I mean, I imagine when you have that many episodes to write, you're like, I will take my inspiration where I can find it.
Yeah. The first actor to play Davros, a person called Michael Wisher, he wanted to really commit to the prosthetics during rehearsals. They obviously didn't have his prosthetics to play one of the Doctor's nemesis, Davros, ready just yet for the rehearsals. So the entire time, he spent the rehearsal period with a paper bag on his head to simulate the restricted view and movement he would get. Bear in mind, Michael Wisher was a chain smoker.
Did he have to have an extra hole for the cigarette to go in?
Yeah, he had an extra long cigarette holder, maybe. One more design thing. I like K-9 is one of the more recognisable Doctor's companions, a Time Lord's best friend, little robot dog. First appeared in Doctor Who in 1977 as a friend to the fourth Doctor. And they had a few different ideas of what they'd call it. Originally, they were going to call it Pluto, but obviously a certain company called Disney, which now owns Doctor Who, put its foot down. And then they considered calling him Fido, which would have stood for Phenomenal Indication Data Observation.
It's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, the article I read here says they dropped that idea, presumably after realising it was really stupid. And the other idea they had for K-9 was to have a human actor inside a small Doberman costume.
That, I'm deeply upset that that didn't come to pass.
Yeah, I think they've settled on a robot instead of an actual dog. but I've saved what I think is the best to last. And again, thanks to our social media manager, Nell, for this one. In terms of sort of Doctor Who design, you know, some of the things looked a bit shonky or to our modern eye. And you have to bear in mind that basically Star Wars came along and changed the entire landscape for sci-fi.
Yes.
So up until the mid to late 70s, Doctor Who was fine as far as anyone could tell. And then you had... You had Star Wars and Industrial Light and Magic and LucasArts going, oh wait, but it could also look like this. So there is one Doctor Who episode where they do like a camera follow through like a 6-foot model of a space station they made, and it looks very cool and quite Star Warsy. And then the rest of the episode looks so shit in comparison to it because they've spent like 6,000 pounds at the time, quite a lot of money on this one shot.
But it's that weird thing with Doctor Who that, and again, I know I won't appreciate this hugely because I've not watched it for decades and decades, but that, you know how with the Star Wars reboots, and I'm sure I've said this before on the podcast, they got it right because they realised you had to have a Star Wars face. You had to have that weird sort of 70s bone structure that
yes,
that didn't exist for the Phantom Menace and all that. And it's the same.
You want to be able to feel the rickets.
Yeah. And with Doctor, which are obviously a race of aliens who appear in series 13 of Doctor Who. But
I think Douglas Adams's original script for Doctor Who included some people from the planet Cricket, which appears later in the Hitchhiker's Guide episodes. Yeah.
Of course it would. But the one of the characters from the one just shown this weekend, it's clearly a bloke in a suit. But it's sort of a credible bloke in a suit, if you know what I mean. And there's certain things about the way it's shot that you're like, it's sci-fi looks a bit incongruous in the United Kingdom because we're so used to seeing it on an epic American scale. And it's I love that, particularly with the reboot, and maybe this is true of the previous stuff, that you get sci-fi in a suburban British setting, which is very pleasing aesthetically.
Yeah, there's a real like smashing together of like the mundane domesticity and then the immense grandeur and overwhelming size and potential of the universe. Also, shout out to friend of the show and past guest Matt Green for popping up briefly in the most recent Doctor Who episode. Yeah,
I yelped with delight when that happened.
Yeah, very lovely to spot him as a news anchor. But no, thank you to Nell for bringing to my attention the Chameleon, a shape-changing android voiced by Gerald Flood. And it was a companion of the Fifth Doctor. And I say companion in the lucid terms because it suggests, like a lot of the Doctor Who companions, it was travelled around with them and had many adventures over the course of several years. The Chameleon appeared between 1983 and 84, basically twice. Mm-hmm. And it was the backdrop of the Chameleon is it's a tool of a renegade Time Lord called the Master, who's again one of the Doctor's great nemeses. And the Master forces Chameleon to pose as King John, the King of England, when the Doctor meets the Chameleon in 1215 AD. And the Doctor frees him from the Master's grip and it joins the Doctor in the TARDIS, but it falls under the Master's influence again in the serial Planet of the Fire, and he begs the Doctor to destroy it. And the Doctor uses the Master's tissue compression eliminator to shrink him down. And the last that's seen of the Chameleon is a doll-sized robot shell lying on a floor with wires hanging out of it. It made a brief illusory appearance in the caves of Androzani. Again, apparently the greatest episode ever made, but it does feature this really shit companion. There's also, I think I love about this character, is there's basically no reference to it between its two appearances. So it's just on the ship, not being talked about. And part of that is that it was just impossible to use. The producer had spotted this machine, and it's like a humanoid robot thing, painted silver, somewhere in the BBC, and wanted to include it in Doctor Who. It wasn't made for the show, like most of the other props and aliens and monsters would have been. It was just something he'd seen in a corner. And unhelpfully enough, the Chameleon's software designer, a chap called Mike Power, had been killed in a boating accident shortly after they decided to include it in the TV show. A sad thing. But also, nobody knew how to use his machine because he hadn't left any instructions on how to program it. So... Oh, it's so good, because they've got this like, oh, we want to use this machine. It looks really cool. How do we use this thing? No idea. Oh, well, in that case, they literally came up with an in-universe explanation for the fact it just didn't leave the TARDIS. In the episode The Crystal Bucephalus, they mentioned the Chameleon's automatic loyalty to strong minds. So the Doctor was the Master was able to control it because the Master has such a brilliant mind. So they didn't want him to fall under the power of another strong mind and turn on the Doctor. So we'll just leave him in the TARDIS.
Surely you can just have as an excuse, listen, I'm a 1,000-year-old time traveller. I'm going to pick up some knickknacks here and there, aren't I?
Yeah. So thank you very much to Nell for bringing to my attention this... an android robot someone picked up in a props room in the BBC that no one had the instructions for, and then they went, oh, let's just write it out, let's just make it never leave the TARDIS. But that's the sort of thing we love about Doctor Who. There are so many instances of people dropping lines, wobbly sets. There's a shot in the Pyramids of Mars where the villain stands up and you can see a hand moving because it's holding the cushion that he's been sitting on. It's just so good in its homespun can-do attitude of the early days. And now it's become this massive international success and part of the Disney portfolio that it's only going to go from strength to strength, I'm sure.
It's only a matter of time before the Black Widow Doctor Who crossover has, since, you know, Disney owns both Marvel and Doctor Who.
Yeah, you can see him joining the Avengers, can't you? The show is very important for a lot of people in lots of ways. It was a home for outcasts and misfits and nerds and people who didn't, you know, maybe necessarily didn't have happy home lives. They could escape into space and time with the Doctor, and obviously it's become a home for a lot of people who are identify as queer. And the most recent episode addressed the fact that the Doctor can be man and woman and neither and both and everything all at once. There's a lot of my experience of Time Fracture, of course, we had a lot of queer and neurodivergent audience members, as well as families, old and, you know, three different generations of families coming to it.
It's weird. It is both absolute mainstream canon, pillar of the United Kingdom society, and also, like you say, for waif, strays, outcasts and weirdos. There's a story, yep, I'm sure you'd seen it doing the rounds on social media every 6 months or so, and I think it's Tom Baker. It's either Tom or Colin, but I think it's Tom Baker. And he says, it's weird being who I am. I'll get recognised out in the street, and often it's people who are in their 30s or 40s. So when they recognise you, you see the child in them. And he said he was walking through London, maybe in the 80s, And this guy came up to him and he literally couldn't talk, this man in a suit. He was like, you were him. And eventually he can talk. He was just like, I was in a children's home when I was little. It was hell, except for every Saturday night at 8 p.m. when you were on. And then he said just words failed the man, and he just kept doing his thumbs up at him. And in the story, Tom Baker says that thumbs up, it was a medallion, it was a knighthood, it was the greatest acclaim I have ever received, because that's who the show was for.
And it's having been a very small cog in its enormous machinery, I can say that the feeling, that's a feeling is shared by a lot of people. So long may it rain.
It long may rain. And also, the theme tune slaps.
The most recent incarnation with the orchestra playing it. I'm gonna go watch that right now on YouTube. Listen, folks, just sit down and watch and listen to the extended version, not just the first like 30 seconds.
Oh, I was also going to say, while you're there, like, do that, then listen to Orbital's proper rave version. And then there's a band, who I can't remember, they're called something like the Anti-Smerins Collective, who do like a Persian Russian klezmer version. That, again, both slaps and does this with its hands.
Listeners, I think, can imagine what this with its hands is.
Yes, sorry, slaps and shrugs.
This has been an extra long third foot, rightly so, but time is very malleable, as I think we've learned. Ben and I are all off to have an adventure together. Allons-y, and we'll see you next time.